During the early morning hours of May 30th, as night gave way to day, I and many others like me set out on a fascinating journey, standing stationary, transfixed in front of my TV. The journey picked up speed. As the minutes passed, the journey accelerated. On my way to shul that morning for the 7 o'clock minyan, and as congregants filed in to report to me, it became certain that in a short few hours, we had moved. We had moved defiantly from the despised extreme right of the political spectrum, and the movement continued by Mushtaba. I was standing firmly in the center of the ideological divide. From being the outsiders, we had become the insiders, those bumper stickers in Eretz Yisrael, Yemin Ze'in, the right is in. Finally had become true. It may be a bit overdramatic, but so what? So I'll be a little overdramatic. As that morning began to dawn, I thought of the famous story in the Talmud Yerushalmi of two rabbis who are walking in the valley of Arbel at the early morning, as night gives way today, and one turned to the other and he said, "Kachi geulatan shel Yisrael." So will come the redemption of the Jewish people, little by little, but with absolute certainty. That morning I felt that the process of redemption was back on track. It was one of the glorious mornings, joyous days that we've had in a long, long time. Shmona Esrei that morning in Kehilat Zichron Yosef was a song of praise and thanksgiving. The people had spoken loudly, firmly, and with defiance, and with a vengeance. I could finally come to Toronto to speak on behalf of the democratically elected government of the state of Israel. That was not my pleasure during the course of the past few years. I had the painful task of coming here and speaking in opposition against the elected government of the state of Israel. As May 30th dawned, the Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment, was over. A nephew of mine who was a Mashgiach in Yeshivas Itni in Yerushalayim said, some of his students said, "You know, election day is going to be the Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment." He said, no. It's a great deal more than a Yom HaDin. Rosh Hashanah comes once a year, but this is once every 4 years. And once every 4 years, we have to make the statement, and we finally made it. There is much to be learned from the struggle. And what I would like to do really this evening, I would like to take some of the points that should stand us in good stead. There are things that we have to learn. And what comes to mind first, something I may have said on a different occasion here. Every few years I decide to clear my desk. You know, things pile up. Comes a time in every man's life when he must tackle the desk, get rid of all the garbage. So I began. And the first thing was I had a 1986 calendar on the desk. 1992, 1993. One could safely say that that 1986 calendar was simply no longer terribly important to me. So I threw it out. And then I go, no. I picked it up. I think I understand. Let's take a look again at how important it was. By the way, it was a Gamma Lab calendar. And it had aphorisms, and each page had a good word. And I came across a word that astounded me. It was a quote from Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan said, "I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it." Now you have to give yourself a few moments for that to get into your kismet. It has to be repeated. "I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it." Here my whole life I've been brought up to believe seeing is believing. Kunz Marshall McLuhan. And he says, no, it's not so. Believing is seeing. I felt that the book was so good, somewhere our rabbis had to say something like it. It happened to be the month of Elul. I went to davening in the morning, the whole davening is bothering me. Great work by Marshall McLuhan. And then I come to the end of davening, and Eureka, it was there. We're going to start saying L'David Hashem Odi. And till the end of L'David Hashem Odi, it says, Lulei He'emanti L'Od V'Tuch Hashem V'Eretz Chayim. If I wouldn't have believed it, I wouldn't have seen the goodness and the greatness of God in the land of the living. Lulei Hamati. I read David Amela. He did it. I had to wait for Marshall McLuhan. Lulei Hamati Lidos B'Tuch Hashem. And then I went even further. All of a sudden it struck me. I take a look at the Aron Kodesh in Shul. And on the Aron Kodesh is emblazoned the Pasuk. Zeh Keli va'anveihu, this is my God, and I will exalt him, Elokei Avi va'Avraham, remember the God of my father, and I will uplift him. One of my favorite Rashis in Chumash, I know my students accuse me that every Rashi in Chumash is favorite, but this is, you know, all Rashis are equal, but this one is more equal. The Rashi is obviously troubled. Jews at the Red Sea are able to point. They see him. And then they continue on by saying, Elokei Avi, the God of my father, and I will uplift him. Why do they have to say the God of my father? They see him, they experience him. There he is, for all to behold. Says Rashi, Lo ani tchilat hakedusha, I am not the beginning of all of this sanctity, elo muhzeket va'omedet li kedushato ve'elukuto alai yimei avotai. That sanctity, that divinity, that knowledge of God is something that I have received from my fathers. I have faith. Do you know what Rashi is saying? Do you know why Jews saw God at the Red Sea? Because they believed. If they wouldn't have believed, they wouldn't have seen. Lulei he'emanti lirot. They were able to point and say, Zeh keli va'anveihu, this is my God, for only one reason. Because God was Elokei Avi, the God of my father. Because they had believed. Because they had believed. I even saw this week a Gemara in Bava Basra, where the Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan told one of his students that in times to come, God is going to build, he's going to build the walls of Yerushalayim out of precious stones. It was last week's Haftarah. And there was a student who, really, you can't be, what are you talking about? Precious stones. The walls of Yerushalayim are going to be gems. It seems the student went off visiting someplace. And of all things, he saw angels preparing walls made out of gems. So the student asked, what are you doing? They said, we are preparing these walls made out of precious stones. We are preparing them for Yerushalayim. The new walls of Yerushalayim are going to be Avanim Tovot u'Margoliot. Student comes back to Rebbe, Rebbe Yochanan, and says, Rebbe, you know, what you told me is true. I saw the angels indeed preparing that for the walls. Said Rabbi Yochanan to him, Reiko, you empty one, you empty one. Il moleda ita, if you wouldn't have seen, lohe amanto, you wouldn't have believed. If your Rebbe tells you it's so, that's not enough for you. You have to see it. You know what Rabbi Yochanan is saying? Rabbi Yochanan is saying is if you believe, you see. If you don't believe, you don't see. One of Labor's fatal errors during the course of the campaign, an error that they repeated over and over again, they failed to see the impending disaster. Because they refused to believe that it was possible. They had held the right in general in absolute contempt. We were abused and we were vilified. And Benjamin Netanyahu, in particular, as far as they were concerned, meant nothing. The man is a nothing. He'll never be elected. They never believed it. Because they didn't believe that it was possible, they failed to see the disaster that was going to befall them. Thank God. Thank God. Netanyahu, who love or that liga, I will translate. He's not in the same league as Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres is a statesman, a man of world stature. Rashidas, young in the Tanyola, God is the God. Who love or that liga. They didn't even want to have a television debate. It was only at the last moment that they decided on it. Because there was tremendous pressure, why wouldn't they have a television debate? To put Shimon Peres with Benjamin Netanyahu on the same platform would be giving the man some kind of legitimacy. But Bibi is another. They didn't believe that it was possible. They didn't believe that it was possible that they were going to lose. And of course they didn't believe, they didn't see. They didn't see polls. There's a fellow who's become very famous now in Eretz Yisrael called Yossi Vadana. Yossi Vadana is a pollster. And Yossi Vadana, for 6-7 weeks before the election, had said it was going to be neck and neck with the chances of Netanyahu winning. They refused to look at it. They threw him out with his polls. Nobody wanted to pay any attention to it. Because they were living with the same terrible mistake that they lived with Erev Yom Kippur 1973. They believed with perfect faith that Egypt and Syria will never attack. Either there are hundreds of thousands of soldiers at the borders. There are 4,000 tanks poised against Eretz Yisrael. Don't you see the attack that's coming? They couldn't see. Because they didn't believe that it was possible. They're going to attack us. And because they didn't believe, they didn't see. They weren't able to see the truth staring them in the face. They just couldn't see it. They didn't believe, so they didn't see. Maariv had even published a month before the election, was a front page story on a Thursday, that the United States has its own pollsters in Israel, and the American pollsters are showing that it's going to be Netanyahu by 1%. The following day, the only thing you read about it in all the papers was a two-line denial in the Jerusalem Post. American government said they had no pollsters in Israel. I mean, we now know, of course, that it was all not true. They certainly had their pollsters. And they knew exactly what was happening. They were convinced that victory was so certain, they simply paid no attention to what was happening around them. The defeat of labor goes even deeper. And what I'm interested in is, what then is that we can learn from it? It's painful, but it's clear now, and it has to be said over and over again. The previous government lied to the people. They lied to the people over and over and over again. From the very beginning of the Oslo process, they continually, constantly, viciously lied to the people. How many times did they promise Palestinian state? What are you talking about? Sure, your Palestinian state. Anybody who goes down from the Golan Heights leaves all of Israel open to attack. I remember when I said it here 2 years ago, there were people who became extremely angry with me. But the representatives of government always knew if they wanted to get a crowd going, if they wanted to make sure that people were going to stop pulling out their Kleenexes and dabbing a tear, they would say, Jerusalem will forever remain the eternal, undivided capital of the state of Israel. They said it over and over and over again, and every time they said it, they were lying. And when 2 years ago, in this room, to be precise, on January 31st, 1994, 2.5 years ago, I said that the government, the present government, now, thank God, the former government, would divide Yerushalayim. There were people who looked at me as though I had come out of Mars. Couldn't be. It was clear that this is exactly what they planned, and now we know that they had already done so. Done so. You remember the famous Arafat tape in Johannesburg where he said that Peres had given him a letter about Jerusalem. Peres is confronted by Benny Begin. Letter? What letter? For 3 weeks? What letter? No letter. 3 weeks later, Benny Begin pulls out the letter. Oh, that letter! We were being lied to, and Jerusalem, of course, was the big lie. I know there were people from Toronto who were upset with me when I personally heckled and challenged Peres at a gathering of the Jewish agency in Yerushalayim. I challenged him on the issue of Yerushalayim, and of course he swore on a stack of declarations of principles that they'll never divide Yerushalayim. It was that evening that three people in succession accused me of being a zealot. Now that became very name. Right-wing extremist, of course, it was a terrible name, but a zealot. And I'll tell you, that came back to me today. I don't know who the guy is. I should have gotten his license plate. I was driving along Bathurst Street today, and a fella had a sign hanging from the back of his back window. Yamutu Hakanaim. Let the zealots die. If that fella would be traveling with a car like that in Eretz Yisrael today, he'd be hauled off to jail for sedition and incitement to riot. It happened to me today on Bathurst Street. If you see that car, I should have gotten his license plate. What a terrible, terrible thing. The lie, the big lie of Yerushalayim, most probably approached its ugliest when in the televised debate between Benjamin Netanyahu and Shimon Peres before the election, Peres was able to say with a straight face that from his very youth, from my very youth, what has accompanied me throughout my life is the pasuk in Eshtachei Yerushalayim, Tishkach Yumin. He was able to say it. He was able to say it in the middle of that debate on TV. When you lie to the people, there are two things that happen. One doesn't have to wait for a thunderbolt to come down from heaven in order to punish. There are two punishments for people who lie. Number one, you know what happens? The people lie back. Do you know how the people lie back? I'll tell you exactly. For the last 6-7 months, there are 11 to 16% of the people who are undecided. Undecided in all the polls, 11 to 16% who are undecided. I don't believe for a minute that there was a single Jew in Eretz Yisrael that was undecided as to how he was going to vote in this election. He knew exactly how he was going to vote. Not only that, they were waiting to walk into that ballot box. They were waiting for the moment of the election. They lied. We know now for a fact that on election day, I'm afraid to say some of my best friends did it, the exit polls, when you come out of the polling booth, so the TV was there to find out how you voted. They just asked you vote outside as you voted inside. On the basis of that, they were going to make their predictions that were going to be broadcast at 10 o'clock at night. Certainly in the religious neighborhoods and in many others, people who voted Netanyahu inside voted Peres for the TV. They all admit it now. They admit now that it's possible that in certain sectors of the country, 35% of the people lied. When you lie to the people, they're going to lie back to you. By the way, there was good reason to lie. Because from the moment of the assassination on, not many people wanted to say that they're standing firmly on the right. People were afraid. People were afraid to say the truth. So the first thing that happens when you lie to the people is that the people are going to lie back to you. And the second, of course, is that you're going to lie to yourself. Ultimately, the liar lies to himself, refuses to see the truth that's staring him in the face. They kept saying, it's in the bag, they have it, they have the country sewn up. Not a chance in the world that Netanyahu is going to win. The right has been crushed, the right will never rise again. You lie to yourself. You lie to yourself. And that's the greatest tragedy of all. The very first step in the process of tshuva that we begin now with the night of the Chodesh. Kalman says the very first step is Hakaras Hashem. I have to see myself and look at myself truthfully. I have to be able to say with all honesty and sincerity, Chodesh. I sinned. And I want to rebuild my relationship with you. The fundamental bedrock upon which all of repentance is based is truth. Absolute truth, even if it's painful. But one must be truthful with oneself. That's where it begins. If you lie, you ultimately end up lying to yourself. And that's the greatest tragedy. That's the greatest tragedy of them all. I recall a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Al-Ti-Boz L'chol Adam, Al-Ti-Mafli L'chol Davar. Don't abuse any man Don't say about anything that it can't be. Don't be that absolutely certain that it can't be. Speaking of Altihi Boz L'chol Adam, and this Peres was finally able to admit after the beginning. The right, those of us who are on the right, those of us who moved to the center, we were abused, we were treated with contempt, we were vilified. We were not merely the outsiders. We were the ones to be crushed and to be destroyed. The attack on anybody who didn't believe what the government was telling them was vicious. And it took courage in order to take a position and maintain that position. There's a Rambam, beautiful Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva says the following: We're going to start blowing the shofar soon too. Tkiyas shofar, the sounding of the shofar, even though it is a mitzvah in the Torah, remez yesh bo, there is also a message and a lesson. And the lesson is: awaken you who sleep, arise you slumberers, those who become carried away with the daily life, the nonsense of daily life. Arise, make the great cheshbon hanefesh. Lefichach. The Rambam goes on to say, lefichach, therefore, yireh kol adam atzmo, every person has to see himself as though he's chetzio chayav v'chetzio zayin. Every person has to see himself as though he has 50% avedas and 50% mitzvahs. And you have to take a look at the whole world. You have to imagine the whole world, that the whole world is 50% innocent, 50% guilty, which places such an awesome responsibility on the individual. And the Rambam tells us, therefore, in the event that a person is going to perform one mitzvah, it's all 50-50. Everything is hanging in the balance. You perform one mitzvah, then you have given yourself and the whole world life. You do one aveda, and you bring destruction upon yourself and the world. You tip the scales against you and the world. I had once asked, why doesn't the Rambam consider a third possibility? He considers two possibilities. You're going to do an aveda, or you're going to do a mitzvah. Why not the third possibility? You do nothing. You abstain. You know what the Rambam is saying? In life, there's no such thing as abstaining. A human being takes a position, either one side or the other side. Not to take a position is not to be allowed. Not to take a position on something that is so terribly important to Jewish life is not to be Jewish. But what fascinates me now even more about that Rambam, the Rambam is setting up for you a hypothetical situation. Imagine yourself as though the whole world, 50% innocent, 50% guilty, you're perfectly delicately balanced 50-50. And whatever you're going to do now is going to make all the difference in the world. We in Eretz Yisrael, as we approach the elections, I said that this Rambam is not something that you have to imagine. The Rambam is the fact. We were living knowing that everything depended on every individual. It was hanging in the balance. Anybody can make the difference. Anybody can make the difference. Has anyone felt that? The right felt it. The right felt it. On election day, my mother-in-law, Balera Shalom, Sarah Rubinoff, to whom I want to dedicate this lecture. She had been in her first time in hospital for about a month, and she was released 2 days before election day. She was at home again for another two and a half weeks after that until she returned to the hospital for the last time. On election day, she wanted to go vote. You understand? She wanted to go vote. Likud was in touch with us. They were ready to come with an ambulance, take her by stretcher, so she should be able to vote. It was only about 6 o'clock in the afternoon that she told me, Sean, I don't have, she just didn't have the energy. She didn't have the energy to go vote. I told her, Shtiga, I hope Perez doesn't win by one vote. At 6 o'clock in the afternoon, Likud called and they were ready to take it, and they were doing it all over the country. On the block on which I lived, the block of the shul, there were a number of aged, old, infirm, handicapped people. They would come with cars, they would keep them in wheelchairs, out to the cars, to ambulances, down to the poles. It was a mission, it was a mitzvah. I told my people in shul, after davening in the morning, the first thing, the first mitzvah, zrizu magdinim, the mitzvah, you have to go out and go to the poles. And I tell you, when I got to my station in Harnof over there, my members were there before me, had to wait in line. People saw it as the great mitzvah. They were waiting, the anger of 4 years. They didn't just vote, you understand? We put that thing into the ballot box. The Rambam had set up a hypothetical situation, but in Eretz Yisrael it was a fact, and we understood it, and we felt it. We knew that everybody counts. Everybody counts. I had told my people I was out on the campaign trail. I never did it before. And so I was really on the campaign trail. I was speaking in it. I was speaking around in Shalayim, another place I was speaking for, on behalf of the Mafdal, that's the National Religious Party that is one of the sponsors of this evening, and for Netanyahu, and we told people that everything depends on each and every individual. You have to go out there. Oh, one of the great things I coined was a vote for Netanyahu. Is a vote for a return of national sanity, a rejection of national suicide. A vote for the National Religious Party is a vote for a return to national sanity. There were a lot of people out there working, and the victory, this victory indeed, has many fathers. I'm proud to have been a member in good standing, or certainly heavily involved with the Ikud HaRabbanim, the union of over 1,500 rabbis in Israel. We were the first ones to come out firmly on behalf of Binyamin Netanyahu. We were then, as a result of that, obviously the Mafdal, the National Religious Party, followed us. And then one after another, until the very day of the election itself, but one thing we made absolutely certain, that people should know the value and the importance of each individual. The previous government treated us with absolute contempt. We were abused. We were delegitimized. There was an intent to demoralize. When Oslo II was passed by the cabinet, and members of the cabinet came out to speak to the press, 3 or 4 of the members of that cabinet said precisely the same thing. The dream of Eretz Yisrael HaShlemah, the dream of greater Israel is over. If members of the cabinet would have come out and they would have said, we've had to make a very painful decision. We've made a decision to give land for what we hope will be peace. I would disagree, but I would not be angry. It seems that was secondary. What was really important to them was, we've destroyed you, religious Jews. Your dream of a greater Eretz Israel, we've destroyed it. That seemed to be more important. Or Peres referring to the Golan Heights as Haramah HaSuriyot, the Syrian Heights. Absolute lie. Golan Heights was always part of Eretz Israel. Or Rabin HaManoach, who said that the Golan, this is tank land, it's not holy land. Or talking about Hebron to have made the comment, it's only real estate. It's only real estate. This is the way one talks about the cradle, the birth of Klal Yisrael, the city of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Real estate. We were abused. We were vilified. We were defamed. And in particular, what gave me a great deal of pain was the terrible attack of the government on our Rav Nochum Rabinovich Shuda, one of the great Talmidei Chachamim of Eretz Yisrael, a man of sterling quality. And they dragged him through the mud. And there were people in Toronto and Eretz Yisrael who had the courage to stand up on his behalf. A Talmid Chacham of such stature. Abused, defamed, and vilified in such a horrible way. And what the government didn't understand, they didn't understand that we were going to pay them back for it. They didn't understand that the Yom HaDin was going to come. And the silent individual is going to use that tremendous and awesome power that he has when he goes into that booth tomorrow. We were going to use it. And we used it. Of course, there was the great attack against rabbis in general. It was just no more than a year ago that the Ikud HaRabbanim, with Rav Avraham Shapiro at the head, he came out with the Psak Halacha. The Psak Halacha. The psak that shook the world. Only the abuse that was heaped on us. And the abuse that came from the non-religious world, I can understand. But there were even those within the religious world who attacked us. Because we said that Israeli soldiers are prohibited from removing Jews from their homes. At the end of the 20th century, did we create an army that was going to follow orders? Or is there a moral law that stands higher than the ugly policy of a government? Does a soldier have a right to say, I will not do this? I will not be the one who's going to break into a Jewish home and tell Jews, you rats! And from where? From Bethel? From Hebron? From Kedumim? From Shiloh? From Eli? And because we passed in this, we came under such terrible fire. We were right. And not only we were right from the point of view of Halacha, and from the point of view of Jewish morality, we were right because ultimately, with everything that is coming out now, what agreements were made? Do you realize that in the secret agreements that were made with the PLO, No settlements are to be dismantled. Do you know why no settlements were to be dismantled? Because they know, as well as we know, that the rabbis are the ones who have the divisions. The best soldiers in the Israeli army today are the boys of Yeshivat Hesder. The Kibbutz Neviot was just this week in Ma'ariv. Terrible series of articles in Ma'ariv. It's been now going on, I think, for 6 weeks, a study of the army. And the conclusion came this week that there's a terrible, terrible problem of motivation. There is no longer the motivation that once existed. Tzahal, the Israel Defense Forces, it pains me to say it, but there it was, it's for all to see. Everybody's commenting on it today in Eretz Israel. The Israel Defense Forces are not what they once were. Not once, but what they once were. They haven't been able to mount a truly successful operation in years. And in the Ma'ariv editorial of last Friday, they said, begrudgingly, we must take our hats off to the boys of the Yeshivat Hezger, the most highly motivated soldiers in the Israeli army. They are our Talmidim. The rabbis will pass them. The rabbis will pass them. That a soldier dare not leave a Jew from his home. They knew it was our divisions that would have to do the job. And they weren't going to do it. So they vilified us. They made fun of us. We were dirt. But they knew the truth. They knew that our boys are not going to do it. And therefore, it's not part of the plan. They'll divide you in Shalayim. They will annex 70% of these settlements, but there was never talk anymore of dismantling settlements. The Psak Halacha made all the difference in the world. And we called a special gathering at the Renaissance, over 700 people came, only for one reason. In order to pledge our allegiance to Rav Nachum Rabinovich and the others who were under attack. It was a tremendous Kiddush Shem Shemayim, and that was no more than about 6-7 weeks after the assassination, to be able to stand up then and say that yes, terrible tragedy, the assassination was a terrible, terrible tragedy. Terrible. But it does not change our basic approach. It does not change what we're going to believe in. And I read at that gathering in the Renaissance, I read a number of sentences from Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. There were so many people who went bending around Rav Soloveitchik. I had this feeling that he had more Talmidim after his passing than he had in his life. Everybody was walking around my Rebbe said. And enough of the people who walk around saying, my Rebbe said, were quoting him as though he was further left than Balaam. It can't get further left than that. I'll quote from Rav Soloveitchik. Unfortunately, there are those in Israel who want to uproot Judaism from the source. They want to destroy all bridges between both segments of the Jewish people. There are those who choose to have a secular state. I hope that this will never, ever happen. And all of their plans will come to naught. However, in Tutsag Lanu HaSheilah, if we will be presented with the question, Bameh Onu Bokhanim, what do we choose? This was one of the lectures that he gave before the Mizrahi in America. If we would be asked, what do we choose? Medinat Yisrael Chilonit, a secular state of Israel that has cut its ties with the past? Or do we choose the God of Israel? Halo Tavinu, you must understand. Ki Kulanu, Per Echad, all of us, in unison, Nivchar Be'elokei Yisrael. We're going to choose the God of Israel. The secular state does not stand above Torah. And a Sakhalaka stands higher than the Supreme Court of the state of Israel. A Elokei Yisrael stands higher. And that's what they're going to do. So we were abused. I will be abused. We were called the crybabies, the propellers. We were called the collaborators with Hamas. What? I'll tell you, I came in for very special vilification. Yossi Belda, I only remember it now. One of the things that I do take pride in is last year it was during the month of May and June. I spent on two occasions 5 weeks in the United States, and on June 13th, I led a march of 150 rabbis to Washington. And we went to Washington in order to ask of Congress and Senate not to give money to the Palestinian Authority unless they comply with the Declaration of Principles. Unless they comply. It made a lot of sense. I spoke to congressmen and senators, and they said, yeah, what are you talking about? Of course these gangsters have to comply, these baby terrorists. I mean, of course I can't use the kind of language American senators and congressmen use. But use your imagination. They understood me. They understood. What are you talking about? Of course they understood. They couldn't understand it. These fellows that there. What do you mean, give them money? Remember, I think I counted the same June I came. Lincoln States my second time in order to lead the march to Washington. So Rabin Zichrono Baruchah was on the plane, and he was in first class. We were just down there in Sardinia. You got it all wrong. That guy's not an anti-Zionist. He's not an anti-Semite, and he's a rabbi. He's a rabbi and rabbi. But this was it. It was all part of delegitimization. If you said or did anything that disagreed with government policy, you were in the doghouse. You were made to feel absolutely like dirt. So therefore I went out on the campaign trail, and we all understood. We all understood that another 4 years of a leftist government, Eretz Yisrael simply could not survive it. So we went out. I tell you, Toronto came into the picture a number of times. First of all, you have to understand the last 3 days of the campaign, the Chabad campaign. The Chabad campaign will be studied for years to come. like the Battle of the Bulge. Like Entebbe beginning to study the Chabad campaign. It hit the country only 2 days before the elections, and there was absolutely no way for Labor to fight back. You got up one morning, and across the country, there are signs, Netanyahu said, Tov la'Yehudim. Netanyahu, it's good for the Jews. That Netanyahu said, Tov la'Yehudim. I mean, even the leftists now who've been writing about the campaign said that was absorbed into the neshama all over Eretz Yisrael. Netanyahu is a Tov la'Yehudim. I mean, the stories, the apocryphal stories that are being told, that I think it was Sunday night before the elections, all over the country, there were in different communities of Chabad, starting at about 3 o'clock in the morning, they would be waking people up. Menachem Mendel, Shteyuf, Shnei Zalman, Shteyuf, Sholder, Shteyuf, the Gate Arabs. And it just crossed the country. They printed out 10 million stickers. Netanyahu said, Tov la'Yehudim, that's about 10 times the number of people that could vote. But they had Netanyahu. And then there were big flyers across the country. Netanyahu said, Tov la'Yehudim. One of the stories, I think it was in the paper, you know who ran this campaign? It was a campaign of brilliant military strategy. Yosef Yitzchok Aronoff, Toronto boy. They tell me that on that Monday morning before the election, Netanyahu was someplace up in the Galil, and from his car phone he calls Yosef Yitzchok Aronoff, and tells him the country is ablaze with Netanyahu's etov by Yehudim. By the way, of course, we not only do we have that, we have a homegrown member of Knesset, Henry Weinberg, who was a member of mine in Bnei Torah, who was elected on Sharansky's party. I mean, Toronto was, I mean, maybe you can even consider me a little bit of a Toronto. But I went out on the campaign trail. So we had a large gathering at the Laurent Hotel that was called by the Jerusalem Post. So I told them, one story, and I had a number of people from the left who went after me. So I said, listen, you want to know the truth? I had been February in, I'm telling them this story, I was in February in Toronto. I went into Negev bookstore and I see Peres' book, The New Middle East, is selling for $4.99. You're reacting very well. So I went over to, I think it was Arthur, somebody went over and I said, I wouldn't have bought it for more, but $4.99. He says, Rabbi, don't be silly, you can get it in New York for 99 cents. So I said, wait a minute. So I said, what about Netanyahu's book? And Netanyahu's book is coming in next week and it's going to be $11.99. I told him, if you dare let the price down on Netanyahu's book, I'll never buy a selfie. So I told them, the new Middle East is worth 99 cents, albeit US, but no more than 99 cents. It was a campaign in which there was such tremendous unity in the religious community. Unparalleled. Walking the streets of Yerushalayim or Bnei Brak on election day, you saw working hand in hand, Rav Shach's people, Chabadnikis, fellas with kippots, you got those who were wearing sandalim with socks and without socks. Everybody was working together. There was a sense of tremendous mission. And I'll tell you something else. You spoke to people in the streets, and they said there was the Neach. You could feel Nitzachon. You could feel the victory. You could feel the victory in the air. You could feel it. What faced voters was the question. This was not an election where the issue was soil as much as it was the soul of the state of Israel. It was not only the safety and the security of the state, but the spirit and the sanctity of the state. It was really the question that was placed before the voters was, state of Israel or Eretz Israel? Which do you want? The secular, westernized state, which have cut its links with the past, and one of the great mistakes Peres made, and he said it during the course of the election campaign, I never look back. I never look back. He meant a number of things. He had cut his ties with the Jewish past. And because he didn't look back, he didn't see Netanyahu gaining on him, but he had just looked behind him. It was a 4 years during which the past was rejected. Post-Zionism had begun. A rejection, those pioneers that came 100 years ago, they were colonialists, they were imperialists. There was a rewriting of Jewish history that was taking place. Frightening. Now, of course, we hope that this post-Zionist era will have been the shortest-lived of them all. The mistake that they made was that they thought that they could crush Jewish spirit. Yiddishkeit cannot be crushed. We have survived so many others, we will and we did survive a labor merits union. Now, of course, they admitted that to have been embraced by the leftists of Meretz was the embrace that kills. It was the kiss of death. So therefore, we've learned a lot of things. Can't lie. Can't lie to yourself. You can't lie to others. We've learned of the importance of the individual. We've learned that if you don't believe it, if you don't believe it, you're not going to see it. We've learned also that one has to have great respect for the ideas of opponents. Can't delegitimize, can't crush, can't destroy. You have to be able to look with honesty, and you have to be forthright. The question now is the following. The great challenge that now faces the state of Israel. The great challenge is the following. How do we make certain that never, ever again will circumstances bring about the establishment of a leftist, anti-religious, anti-Jewish government? We can't ever, ever permit that to happen ever again. The country cannot survive it. Resoundingly, the Jews of Eretz Yisrael said that they want a Jewish Eretz Yisrael. Yes, they said, Zeh Tov LaYehudim, this is good for Jews, and that's fine. So I'm going to be open with you. I'm going to be forthright. I'm going to say it as it is. And you know that it's coming from the bottom of my heart. I'm going to have to tell you, during the 4 years that we stood on the streets, that we stood at street corners, we stood on the highways and the intersections, demonstrating how futile it was. But I kept telling my people, we got to keep demonstrating. The government makes no difference to them, but the Rabbeinu Shlomo is watching every demonstration. He's watching. Jews have to get up and say, we want Eretz Yisrael. We want an Eretz Yisrael that is built on the bedrock of a past, a glorious past. Eretz Yisrael is ours. That's what we want to say. How are we going to make certain that what we lived through during the last 4 years will never happen again? So I'll tell you what we'll be thinking of as we stood in the cold, in the heat, in the rain. Yes, I was thinking it when I was arrested. Yes, if we have another 100,000 religious Jews from North America, they'd never, never be able to rise again. If another 100,000 Jews would be living in Yehuda v'Shomron, take a look. Now, of course, as well, they all admit the 140,000-150,000 Jews of obstacles. Of obstacles. The 150,000 Jews who are living in Yehuda v'Shomron are not the obstacles to peace. They were the obstacles to the Palestinian state. If there wouldn't have been 150,000 Jews living in Yesha, we would have been out of there a long time ago. What happens if it wouldn't be 150,000 but a quarter of a million Jews living in Yehuda v'Shomron and Gaza? 300,000 Jews. And if we... By the way, this government... Previous government. I have to get used to it yet, you know. Our government. The previous government discouraged Aliyah. They discouraged Aliyah. The only one who spoke out a number of times about Aliyah was Weizmann, the president. Bailey kept talking about the fact we don't need your money. Don't you understand that this was all part of a plan? Because they knew
become an Aliyah
from American Canada. Not conservative Jews and not reformed Jews. Chances are they're going to be religious Jews. Even worse, they most probably have come from Brooklyn. They knew exactly how those Jews would vote. They had no use for Olin, because Olin would only weaken their hold on the country. That's a fact. That's why they were opposed. What we have to do now is we have to put Aliyah back on the agenda of the Jewish community. Aliyah has got to be number one. We have to think about it. We have to talk about it. We have to meet about it. We have to find ways of encouraging people. It's a difficult step to take. Change is difficult. Change at certain stages of life, very difficult. I know all about it. But I'll tell you, number one, it's a different Eretz Yisrael you're coming to than it was years ago. If I can walk for an hour on 13th Avenue in Borough Park and not find a single thing to buy that I can't get in Eretz Yisrael, that's progress. I always used to say the prosperity of Eretz Yisrael, I always used to judge it by the tax. The tax. I was on sabbatical about 15 years ago, and you know, at night I'd go out to dump garbage in one of those big garbage bins, and out would jump a whole bunch of cats, and I'd get all frightened and scared. But what can you do? There were such booze to take, the booze to get out there. Cats. They were just skin and bones. Today you take out the garbage, do you know what kind of cat you have? This is a prosperous cat. If I just talk about cats, give me a minute to talk about dogs. And one dog in particular. And my sister and brother-in-law, my brother-in-law, they can now tell you that the story is true. I want to tell you the story of my own decision to make Aliyah. I was rabbi in West Hempstead, Long Island, lived on Colonnade Road, a few houses from us, new family moving on the block, ballet tshuva. And I will say, they became ballet tshuva because of a man called Meir Gaon. Three months ago, I wouldn't be afraid to say that. And in fact, a year, 2-3 years after they were living there, they tell us one day they're going on Aliyah. What? You're going on Aliyah? No chokhmas. You know? They came from, and every page in Torah talks about Eretz Yisrael. They saw that there's only one way to fulfill themselves Jewishly, and that's to live in Eretz Yisrael. And they were absolutely right. They went on Aliyah. They had a beautiful dog, Charlie, and they left Charlie with a neighbor on the block. And every 11 o'clock at night, I'd go out to think about a drosha or a shir. I'd see Charlie, I'd have him. It was a very special relationship between me and Charlie. About a year later, my 11 o'clock walk, a neighbor who's taking care of Charlie says, "Rabbi, you won't believe it. We got a ticket in the mail today. Charlie's going on Aliyah." That was just while I was in the middle of the throes of my own decision, and I said that one in the slum, the hood is going on Aliyah, and I'm not going to go. And we made our decision. Zachor also ha'avun t'chali l'dor. Resh Lakish was the one who said, and this is a very sharp statement, Resh Lakish was one of the great rabbis of the Talmud, made the following statement, I swear to God, Samina Lefu Babloi, I hate you Babylonians that didn't go on Aliyah in the days of Ezra. 700 years after the return of Jews from the Babylonian exile, who came? Ezra and Nehemiah came with 42,000, the dredges of Jewish society in Babylon. They emptied the prisons, the drug pushers. Who knows who ended up over there in Babylon? And they're the ones who built the second Commonwealth. 700 years later, the Shlakish says he was one of those who made Aliyah, and he turned to a Babylonian Jew and said, "I swear that I hate you because you didn't come in the days of Ezra. Would you have come in the days of Ezra as you did in the days of Yahushua? God would have done great miracles. The second Commonwealth would have been the final Commonwealth of God Israel." It's not too late now. The number of people who come to Israel in the last 48 years, they're millions. You can do it now. And the way in which to start is to put it on the agenda of the Jewish community. Send your children to study there. Start visiting. It's a much happier place. It's a much happier place than it was before. Yeah, and I think you're going to get the sense of the excitement of construction that's taking place in Eretz Yisrael. It's our Tzeinu HaKidosha. I'm going to close with a thought that I just saw recently in our book. In davening, we say, Tekah, the shofar of Gadol, the Chayuzen. Sound the great shofar for our freedom. Let's go back to Eretz Yisrael. Said, wait a minute, wait a minute. Hold your applause. Said Rav Kook, what's the shofar Gadol? We say it in davening 3 times a day. What's the big shofar? So he said, you know what? I imagine there's a papa shofar and a mama shofar and a little bear shofar. There's a big shofar, there's a medium-sized shofar, and there's a little shofar. And he says, you know what those three shofarot are? They are power. The big shofar represents the Jew who hears the call of Torah. Mitzvah, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is equal to all other mitzvahs. He wants to go because he wants to go. He goes because of the pull to Eretz Yisrael. I have a friend, sociologist, Chaim Waxman in the United States, who wrote a whole study of American Olim, Mishigoyim. He gives them another title. He calls them, now get this, because you can be one of them too, a free migrant of the innovative type. And does that sound real sociologic ease? A free migrant. Going of one's own free will, the pull of Eretz Yisrael, of the innovative type, could have stayed in America. But he goes. There's a smaller shofar. And in Halacha there are three shofar. The shofar Gadol is the ram's horn. That's the mitzvah ha'mufa. That's where it should be. What happens if you don't have a ram's horn? You can use the horn of any other kosher animal. That's the smaller shofar. What that represents is the one who goes to Eretz Yisrael, maybe even of its free will, but not because he's looking for a more intense and a more meaningful religious life. He's going to Eretz Yisrael because, you know, he wants to live in a Jewish state, in a democracy, you know, and masters our own destiny. Third, the halacha says, and I checked it out, the halacha says it, what happens if you don't have any other shofar and all you have is a shofar that comes from a non-kosher animal? Mishnah Brura Chafetz Chaim says, if you have no other shofar, blow that one. Blow that one. Says Rav Kook, you know what that represents? Not the person who goes to Eretz Yisrael because of the pull. It's the tameh, the unclean sound of the shofar that comes from the anti-Semite, the goy, who pushes the Jew to Eretz Yisrael. We pray every day that Bein Shlomim to carve the shofar Gadol. Let's hear the great sound of the shofar. Let's be the free migrants of an innovative type. Let's be the ones who are now going to participate in building that out. There's so much that we can do. You think they built it all? I'm telling you, they didn't build it all. And even what they did build in the last 4 years, there's been so much that has been destroyed. And the revelation has given us another chance. We have now the opportunity to build a beautiful, a meaningful, a significant marriage as well. And everybody can have a share. It can be children, it can be members of the family. I don't know what happens. Once one member of the family moves there as well, the family, if it's, will it be the Caribbean this year or the Yerushalayim? Didn't be Yerushalayim. There's a member of the family. That's the way it is. We've got to start moving in that direction. I understand that there's a Chug Aliyah. Aliyah is back on the agenda of Eretz Yisrael, of Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael that we can rightly say is Reishit Tzimchat Pu'ulateinu. There's so much there. There's so much there in that Eretz Yisrael. And just as I was campaigning for Mavdal, for National Religious Party, remember that they are in the forefront of Torah. So 250,000 young people are studying Torah in Israeli schools. It's an awesome number. A quarter of a million. In Amuna daycare centers, it's some 20,000-30,000. There's tremendous stuff going on in there. And what we have to do is become part of that great adventure. And Yetz Hashem, as the month of Elul, it's here. It's here. We have to remember the truth. To be honest with ourselves is the first step in the process of tshuva. And we have to listen to that shofar every day and hope that we hear the shofar of the
consented to answer a few questions, so if there are some questions in the audience.
Just a question, but you should have mentioned the fact that the Netanyahu got 10% more of the Jewish vote than Barrett.
All you're reminding me of is that when I'm going to go over my notes, I'll see that I left out half of the speech. You're right. Is that Herb Green back there? I just want you to know, if Herb Green is standing over there, he's not so important, but his daughter and his son-in-law, or their daughter and son-in-law, Mesh and Cheryl Kempinski, when I was talking about people who were standing on the highways and byways of Eretz Yisrael, who were leaders of the struggle, and you know what they always go, I'll let you talk in a minute. Yeah. Everybody always thought that Moshe Kempinski has 10 divisions. They didn't know that Moshe Kempinski has, and Cheryl have, you know, a few people, but they did a tremendous amount. Go ahead, himself.
Yeah.
I'm happy I don't have Netanyahu's job. That's obviously the question of questions. What's going to be with Hebron? What's going to be with Hebron? To be honest, I don't know. What do I think? I think the following. There will be some kind of a redeployment. Nothing close to what was agreed upon by the previous government. Let's say, you know what it's going to be like? It's like Arafat changing the Palestinian charter. Why did it take you that long? You can say you changed the charter, but we didn't need to change the charter. There are ways and means of saying that we've redeployed, you move a few troops here, I don't know. But one thing is certain, he cannot and will not carry out what the previous government had agreed to, because it's a new government. Klal Yisrael is opposed to giving Shabbat to the Arabs. I hope I'm right. I really don't know. Yes. Administrative detentions is extremely painful to all of us. I am convinced that the government is opposed to administrative detention, but I believe that the Binyamin is being very, very, going about things very intelligently. Because the fact is, what we would have wanted within 1 week is that everybody in the administrative detention should be out. Number two, they should throw out all of the reporters for Israel TV. We want a clean sweep. We want everything. I think that he is intelligently going about things. If you want to know inside information, so you know, I can play the game that every representative of the Israeli government says, well, this is not to be said outside of this room, you understand. I want to tell you. You know, you have to know how to do it. But I'm not doing that. But I already have indications that a great deal is being done about administrative detentions. And this is something that is not going to last much longer. Speaking about that, I just had a call a little while ago. Of all people, Shmuel Sackett called me. You know who Shmuel Sackett was? Zuat Zeman, still is. Zuat Zeman. These fellows are coming up to trial. Zuat Zeman is coming up to trial on September 3rd or 5th. I mean, that's going to be the trial, I'll tell you, the trial of the century. They most probably are going to attempt to turn it into a show trial of the policies of the previous government. But the fellows of Zuat Zeman were on the forefront of the struggle. They took tremendous risks, and I'm sure that they will be treated well. Go ahead. Very good question. I'm being very nice to everybody. I'm telling you that your questions are very good. And you should know, of course, that as of the elections, I've gone out of politics. I've gone back to the rabbinate. I mean, I'm not a professional politician. Accountability, the day is going to come. The day is going to come. There's a great deal that I can say about that, but now is certainly not the time. Now is not the time. If I would be asked, I would say now is not the time. Yes?
Personally, I would like to congratulate the Beth Edberg Joseph Synagogue for putting up this Israel News. It is a very important piece of information that we do not get in our daily press. We do not get it in our weekly Jewish news because it's slanted, did too much. However, relative to this, there's something that's being missed in the Jewish community very much, and that is how we can help Israel. North American Jewry has a tremendous job to do to help Israel and Bibi right now, because his hands are tied in public relations war by the State Department and by others. So there's a way to overcome this, to take a moment to explain, and I think we can do a mitzvah if we can implement this strategy.
You have a question?
Yes, the question is, frankly, when are we going to address the public relations inadequacy, the way we're being decimated? How can we start winning the public relations war? We're following the same strategy
for decades, and we're losing for decades. There's a way with a new strategy we can win. It would take a moment to explain the strategy if it's permissible.
Okay, one second.
Good. No, very good.
Excuse me. Rabbi Gold has agreed that he'd like to address the point that you're raising, but we have, if you'll just give me your attention for one more moment, this evening's gathering is also going to be the inauguration of a new Chug Aliyah. You might as well sit down for a couple minutes.
Yes.
It'll be the inauguration of a new Chug Aliyah, a new group which will be meeting here in Toronto and speaking about Aliyah. And to give you some more information about this, I'd like to introduce one of the dynamic leaders of this new group of the Beit Chug Aliyah, Irit Rubin.
When she stood up.
Good evening, everyone.
Use the mic close to the mic. Yeah.
Okay. Rabbi Gold, thank you for these warm words, but you left me with no words.
We're losing you. You've got to have your mouth at the speaker. A bit closer to the mic.
Thank you, Rabbi Gold, for those warm words. I have. You stole all my words. The Yamin is in, and we here decided that Aliyah is in, and the Bayit Shul. Larry Zeitzman has called me a while ago that he has decided this is the most appropriate time to run a Chug Aliyah through the Bayit, and whoever is interested, because this is the right time to encourage religious aliyah. My husband and I have run quite a few aliyah chugim in the last few years through Tehillah, the religious movement for aliyah. Their base is in New York and in Israel, Jerusalem, and Tel Aviv. We've had very successful chugim, and the reason we're not in business right now is because aliyah is a business to become out of business. Most of our people have made Aliyah. Some of them are here this summer, and they're very, very successful. Our Chug is going to be running out of the Bayit. It's going to be for beginners, intermediate, and more interested people. It's an awareness Chug. We're going to be bringing all kinds of speakers, interesting ideas for people that are interested in Aliyah, people that were just beginning to think of it, people that are more interested, have more of an interest. Netanyahu told me Yehudim, and Aliyah is the best for Eretz Yisrael and for the Yehudim. And how Rabbi Gold asked, how can a country survive? How can Eretz Yisrael survive with us, with our most effort for a strong religious aliyah? I'll be here tonight to take your names, phone numbers. Whoever is interested in becoming part of it, we'll keep mailing, we'll have our real phone numbers. We'll have publicity about our get-togethers. Like I say, most likely we'll become part of a Tehillah that they have chugim all over the world. Because that's usually the most successful, I think. They are big supporters, and they give you lots of encouragement. And like I said, my name is Irit Rubin. You can always call me, and we can be in business. Any questions?
Give your name and phone number.
My name is Irit Rubin. This is something. My name is Irit Rubin, and my phone number is 731-0110. Do you know that?
731-0110.
You'll call me. 905. Larry Zeitman. You'll be always happy to answer questions and phone calls. And are we going to meet once a month, once a week, according to the crowd? How does it work?
The intention is to get names people who are in. Nobody will be trying to make any whatsoever.
I'll be here and I can take the names and all questions. Thank you. Yes.
Do you have a
I don't yet. Thank you.
Next week.
But Danita, I'm sure, does.
All right, so close the evening and thank people for coming. That's it.
Okay. If you'd like to come up and speak to Rabbi Gold. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming this evening. Thank you, Rabbi Gold, for your most eloquent.